Thank you very much, Tom. I would like to invite you to go to Hebrews 9, 15 and 22. We're going to study this passage, and I think this is the most important and deep analysis of Jesus' death on the cross in the book of Hebrews. And from there, I would like to invite you to explore the theology of Jesus' sacrifice on the cross in the rest of the book of Hebrews. So this is what we're going to do. Hebrews 9, 15 through 22 is one of the difficult passages that we find in the book of Hebrews. There are several interpretations of this passage. And if you read it there, you're going to find something very interesting. I have put in blue the word covenant there, and also the word will there. Why did I do that? Well, because the word for covenant and for will in the original Greek is exactly the same. It's diatheke. The question is, why do the translators of the Bible change in meaning from the word covenant to the word will in their translations? And that is a very interesting problem that we have there. So if we read there, it says, for this reason he is the mediator of a new covenant, diatheke, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, because a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions under the first covenant, diatheke. Then, where a will is involved, will is diatheke. Where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established, takes effect only at death, since for a will it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. Hence, not even the first covenant, diatheke again, was inaugurated without blood. So we have this transition from the word diatheke, meaning covenant, to the translation of diatheke as a will. The question is, what is Jesus' death in Hebrews? Is this the death of a covenant sacrifice, or is the death of the testator, so that believers can inherit the promises? Well, that is the problem. Those are the translations I have reviewed. Those are CEB, CSB, ESB, NKJ, NET, NIV, NJV. All those translations change from covenant to will. Covenant in verses 15 to will in verses 16 and 17, and back to covenant in verse 8. Thank you. The only translation that I checked, probably there are others, that remains with the same meaning throughout the four verses is the New American Standard Bible. The question is, should there be a change there? Or is Jesus' death in Hebrews 9, 15 to 22 the death of a testator? Or is it here the death of a covenant maker or a covenant sacrifice? So that is the question. Well, there are several reasons why a shift does not work. A shift in meaning does not work. The first reason is that nowhere else in Hebrews does it have any sense different to covenant. So everywhere in Hebrews, diatheke means covenant, no testament. This will be the only place in Hebrews where diatheke would mean testament. Then there is another problem. Hebrews 9:15 to 22 is very clearly connected to the context. It says, for this reason, and so that is implying the argument of Hebrews 9:11 to 14. And Hebrews 9:11 to 14 explains how Jesus entered into the heavenly sanctuary with his own blood. So he's explaining his blood in the sense of a covenant in verse 15. Then, when you go to the second verse 16, there is a word there, gar, that this translation, new revised standard version that you use, does not translate. Why? Because it doesn't make sense. In order to change from covenant to will, they leave out the word God, which means because or for. For, where a covenant is involved, but they change to will. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't match with the previous verse. And then you have four, again explaining, further explaining, Jesus enters us into the heavenly sanctuary with his own blood. Four, again, it is connected to verse 15. So there cannot be a change of meaning there. And then it finishes in verse 8. Hence, therefore, this is the summary, this is the conclusion. Hence, not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. So the flow of the argument does not allow a change of meaning. A shift does not work for another reason. And I'm sad that it doesn't look that very well there, but Hebrews 9:17 says, Diastekegar epi necros, necrois bebaia. That literally translated means, for a diasteke, a covenant is confirmed upon dead bodies. Now, most translations translate diasteke there in verse 17 as testament. But the truth is that wills or testaments in Greek, Egyptian, and Roman laws were ratified or validated, made bebaios, not upon dead bodies, but when they were written down, witnessed, and deposited with a notary. So to translate that as a will, a testament, is simply not, it does not accord with that New Testament law, Roman law, Greek law, Egyptian law. So it doesn't make sense. There's another reason. Then the second part of Hebrews verse 17 says, "Epei mepotes hotese hodiathemeno," since it's never enforced as long as the one who made it, the one who made the covenant or will, is alive. In Hellenistic testamentary practice, a testament disposition could take effect either at the testator's death as donatio or immediately as parental distribution inter vivos. So there was not a necessity for the testator to die in order that other people could receive the inheritance. So this meaning that there was a need for the testator to die for the believers to receive the inheritance, that is not true. It could be done while the testator was alive. But you remember in the prodigal son's parable, father gives his inheritance while he's alive. So there is no need for the death of the testator. So a shift does not work for other reasons. So, in first place, testaments do not require mediators. And in the book of Hebrews, Jesus is the mediator. Second, God does not have to die to leave his inheritance to Israel. Doesn't make sense. Three, the one who dies is the mediator, Jesus, not the testator. So it doesn't make sense to make the change from covenant to testament in this passage. And finally, at death, the mediator does not receive the inheritance, but enters in it. So it doesn't make sense. The question is, why so many translators change from covenant in verse 15 to testament in verses 16 and 17? Well, one of the reasons is that it doesn't work either if you remain with the same meaning. Why? There is a problem. Verse 16 says that where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. And the truth is that the covenant maker does not have to die or in order to establish a covenant. And the other thing is that we know that it is not working only symbolically, either because the death of the animals was not always part of the covenant ritual. So, finally, this passage refers to the real death of the covenant maker. So, this passage, if you remain with the same meaning in all four verses, you have problems. If you change the meaning from covenant to will in verses 16 and 17, you also have problems. What do we do with this passage? What is happening here with Jesus, with Jesus' sacrifice? Well, I think that the key to understand what is going on here is to understand that Paul, or the author of Hebrews, whoever it was, is talking about a broken covenant. Look what is going on here. For this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. Because a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions under the first covenant. The author of Hebrews is not talking about any covenant or the inauguration just of a new covenant. He's talking about a covenant that has been broken. And a covenant that has been broken has several implications to understand the argument of the book of Hebrews in this passage. Let's see this verse 16 again. It says there, for where there is a, now, broken covenant. So, we need to understand this expression, that this passage is talking about a broken covenant. Continue. It is necessary that the death of the covenant maker be born. This is a very interesting translation, because if you read the Bibles, your normal Bibles, you're not going to have this translation. But literal translation, this it says that it is necessary that the death of the covenant maker be born. It doesn't say that it is necessary for the covenant maker to die. It says that it is necessary that the death of the covenant maker be born. This opens the possibility that another person bears the death of the covenant maker. This is important. This word, Pharaoh, here is a very interesting word. Because Pharaoh is related to anaphero, which appears in Isaiah 53, and is used where to say that the servant bore our what? Her sins. And in Hebrews 9:28, it says that Jesus bore our sins. Allusion to Hebrews 9:28. In Hebrews 13:13 says that we need to go out of the camp bearing his reproach. Pharaoh. So in Hebrews 13:13 it says that we need to take Jesus' reproach. This is not our reproach, but we need to take it and bear this reproach that does not belong to us, but belongs to whom? To Jesus. So the translation of Hebrews 9:16 opens the possibility so that another person may bear the death of the testator. Why there was a need for the testator to die? Well, the reason was very simple. The covenant between God and Israel was a covenant that was ratified by blood. Remember Exodus 24, when the covenant was made, there were 12 columns that represented the people, and the altar represented God. And then there was this sacrifice, and blood was sprinkled on the altar and on the columns. What was happening there? If you break the covenant, your life, which is represented by love, by this blood, is forfeited. You're going to die. The one who breaks the covenant needs to what? To die. In other occasions, covenants were made differently. For example, Abraham and God. God asked Abraham in Genesis 15, if I remember correctly, to bring some animals and divide them in two, and he passes. But then the one who passes acknowledges that if he breaks the covenant, his life is forfeited. That is also explained in Jeremiah 34. So that's why Hebrews 9:17 says, for a broken breach covenant is confirmed upon dead bodies. Yes. If the covenant is valid, then the covenant was held what? Tested. If the covenant that God did with Israel was valid, then what happens when Israel broke the covenant? They have to what? To die. That's why Hebrews 9:17 says, a broken covenant is confirmed, is made valid, is strengthened, is said that it was valid when the death penalty is what? Is executed. That's what the Hebrew says. Well, then it says the next verse, since it is never in force as long as the one who made it is what? It's alive. If the one who made the covenant broke the covenant and continues to be alive, what happens? That covenant does not have any force. And that's what he just said. He said, therefore, when there is a broken covenant, there is a need for someone to bear that death. And when the bodies are lying there, then the covenant is confirmed because it has been. So this is why Hebrews verses 9 verses 18 to 23 reminds the reader that the first covenant was inaugurated with what? With blood. Since it was inaugurated with blood, then there is a need for what? A need for a person to bear what? The sin of others. So we find then that Jesus' sacrifice functions at two levels in Hebrews 9:15 to 22, in two levels. It redeems from the penalties occurred under the first covenant, i.e., it has an expiatory function, and has a second function, mediates a new covenant with better promises. That is, it has also a bonding or inauguration function. So Jesus' death at the same time confirms that the Mosaic covenant was valid, and at the same time inaugurates a new covenant. I am not going to go into the direction establishing that Exodus 24 also worked in two levels, but I would like to go in a, there are studies that show how Exodus 24 also have an expiatory function and a bonding function. Both functions were there, but I'm not going to go in that direction. Now, I would like to go a little further in the meaning of this passage. I think that we're not going to understand the depth of this passage unless we understand who is the person who dies in this passage. The verse says, for this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant. Who is he? If you go to Hebrews 9, 11, 12, and 13, we're going to find that the one who is dies and enters the holy sanctuary with his own God is Christ. That is Messiah. the one who is dying is the Messiah. That is an important thing. What does it mean? Well, in Hebrews 1:1-4, the Messiah, Jesus, is the son or the firstborn. The one who is dying is the son or the firstborn. This is important. We're going to go into that very in just a moment. But in Hebrews 1:5-14, he is the king, seated at the right hand of whom? Of God. So the one who is dying is the king, to the firstborn. But the one who dies is also the high priest. He is the high priest according to the order of whom? Of Melchizedek. And the one who dies is the Messiah, is a human divine person. And that is made very clear in Hebrews 1:1-4. Very clearly, he's the exact, he's the creator, he's eternal. Hebrews puts a lot of emphasis on the divinity of Jesus. So the one who bears the transgression is the Messiah, is the son or firstborn, is the king, or is the high priest, and he is a human divine person. Now I want to suggest the following. That in order to understand the transition from the old and new covenant, we need to understand the transition from the Mosaic to the Davidic covenant. Why? Because, and I will not have time to explain all the reasons, but in Hebrews, Jesus is the Son because he is the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant. Hebrews 1:5-6 show and say explicitly that the promise made to David in 2 Samuel 7, that he was going to have a son that was going to be adopted by God as his own son, is fulfilled in Jesus. So Jesus is the Davidic son. So this idea of the Davidic covenant is basic, is important for understanding who Jesus is in Hebrews. So I want to suggest that the transition from the Mosaic covenant to the Davidic covenant explains the transition from the old covenant to the new covenant in Hebrews. And we're going to go in that direction. And, when God chooses David to make a covenant with him, you remember correctly, David was a king according to the heart of God. And he wanted to build a house. And so he calls Nathan and says, you know, I want to build a house. And Nathan says, you know, that's very good. Go ahead and build it. But when he's going out, God tells Nathan, no, David is going to build a house to me? No, I am going to build a house for him. He cannot build a house for me first. I am the one who gives things. So he cannot do that. And then he gives a covenant to him. In this covenant, he offers several things. One of the things that he offers that he's going to give him rest of the enemies, a place for his people Israel, and he's going to have a son who is going to build a sanctuary for him. And he's going to secure his throne forever. And this son is going to be adopted by God as his own what? As his own son. That is what is happening in the Davidic covenant. But what happened with the Davidic covenant? Did the Davidic covenant replace the Mosaic covenant? No! The Davidic covenant did not replace the Mosaic covenant. In fact, Mosaic laws continue to apply. And you have very clear indications. One passage there is 1 Kings 6, verses 12 and 13. Mosaic laws continue to apply. And it is because the people of Israel break Mosaic laws that they are driven into out of the land. So Mosaic laws continue to apply. But there is something very interesting. The Ark of the Covenant is brought into the heart of the nation. Just as the New Covenant writes the law in our hearts, David, when brings the Ark into Jerusalem, brings the symbol of the Mosaic Covenant, he brings it into the heart of the nation. He brings it into Jerusalem. So the permanence of the temple testifies to the permanence of the laws or the permanence of the covenant. So this Davidic covenant does not replace the Mosaic covenant, but only engrafts the monarchy into the existing covenant with the nation. Now, we need to understand something else. Look what it says in Hebrews 7:19-22. But if you turn aside and forsake my statutes, and my commandments that I have set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will choke you up from the land that I have given you. So this is God talking to Solomon. And this house, which I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight, and will make it a proverb and a byword among all the peoples. And regarding this house, not exalted, everyone passing by will be astonished and say, why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this house? Because they will say, because they abandoned the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they adopted other gods, and worshipped them, and served them, etc., etc. So, if they stop obeying the Mosaic laws, they are going to be driven out. The Davidic covenant does not substitute the Mosaic covenant. But there is a very important change. The Davidic king becomes the covenant mediator. Look at this. This is 1 Kings 6, verses 12 and 13, but and I'm going to, there are other passages as well. It says, considering this house that you, Solomon, are building, if you, Solomon, will walk in my statutes, obey my ordinances, and keep all my commandments by walking in them, then I will establish my promise with you, Solomon, which I made to your father David. And I will dwell among the children of Israel, and will not forsake my people Israel. The Davidic king becomes the mediator of covenant in a very interesting way. If he is faithful, God is going to be faithful to whom? To the people. If the king is not faithful, God is going to do what? Drive his people where? Out of the land. So the promises that God gave to Israel now are mediated through the Davidic king. Look at this. Just as Israel is the son of God. You remember when Moses comes before the Pharaoh in Exodus 4:22-23, the first message he gives to Pharaoh he says, let my son, my firstborn, go. If you don't do that, I'm going to kill your son, your firstborn. So Israel is the son, the firstborn of whom? Of God. But David is also the son and the firstborn of God. So, this is very interesting. David, as the son of God, becomes the proxy, the substitute of Israel, which is also what? The son of God. If David is faithful, the Davidic king is faithful, God is going to maintain his promises to the people. God grants to David the promises he made to Israel. In Genesis 15:18 and Deuteronomy 11:24, God promised Israel that he was going to give them the land from the river of Egypt to the Euphrates. And that is exactly what God gives Solomon, according to 1 Kings 4:22 and 2 Chronicles 9:26. Exactly the same promise that he gave to Israel, he is giving to whom? To the Davidic king. Now, in 2 Samuel 7, 9 through 11, God promises to the Davidic king that he's going to give him rest from the enemies. But that is exactly what he promised to the people, Israel, that he was going to give them rest from whom? From their enemies. And now, building a temple for God's name was what the people had to do. But now, that is what the Davidic king can do to Solomon. Now, the Davidic king also fulfills the kingly priestly role of Israel. Because according to the Davidic covenant, 1 Chronicles 17:14, the Davidic king is established, confirmed in God's house. In the house of God. And both David and Solomon fulfill some priestly roles, especially in the inauguration of the temple and the bringing the ark to Jerusalem. So just as the people of Israel was a kingdom of priests, we have a Davidic king, which is a priest king. So very interesting. This is what Abraham Gileadi says. The Davidic covenant did away with the necessity that all Israel, to a man, maintain loyalty to Yahweh in order to merit his protection. If the Davidic king is faithful, who is benefit? The whole people. If the Davidic king is not faithful, who also suffers the consequence? The whole people. The same happens today. We have a good president, a good leader, who receives the benefits? All those who are his people who participate in his leadership. If the leader does not do well, what happens? All the rest also suffer the consequences. So if David was faithful, God was going to be faithful with Israel. What the Brueggemann said, what with David, however, the if had disappeared. In this astonishing promise, Yahweh has signed a blank check to the David enterprise and has radically shifted the theological foundations of whom? Israel. And then there is another one. Since Israel's continuous existence as a people on the land was dependent on her obedience to the covenant, and since the king's ultimate responsibility was to ensure this continuous existence, the king's role was then to make sure that the covenant was observed in Israel. Practically, he could be called the covenant administrator. And good kings in the history of Israel, the first thing they did was to confirm, to renew the covenant between God and the nation. That was the first thing good kings did in the history of Israel. The Davidic king was the administrator of the covenant. So this is very, very interesting. Now, God's promises flow through the Davidic king. I need to go faster. The Davidic king and covenant administration makes possible cultic changes anticipated in Deuteronomy 12. Deuteronomy 12 says that when God gives rest, the Israelites from their enemies, they are going to look for a place where his name is going to dwell, and that is made possible because of David when he finds Jerusalem. And then David reforms the cult according to the instructions that he received by revelation. David's reforms do not substitute Mosaic legislation, but complement it. So David is also reforming the cult in a way that Moses did as well. Now, being the administrator and being charged with the faithfulness of the people, the question I ask, is he blameworthy by the failures of the people? If a company is losing money or not achieving the goals of the company, who receives the blame? Who is fired? The CEO? Would the king be blamed for the unfaithfulness of his people? That is a very interesting question. I don't have the answer yet. But anyway, we have very interesting things as well here. What the Davidic covenant does is to fulfill what God had made in the covenant with Abraham as well. Abraham's covenant included a land kingdom and world blessing. And the Davidic covenant received exactly the same land, is king of several nations, just as Abraham was father of several nations, which can be referring to vassals, being lord of some vassals. And the Davidic king covenant is the law for man, according to 2 Samuel 7:19. The Davidic covenant was not only for the benefit of Israel, but for the benefit of humankind, Adam. So we have here another thing. Let's look at what it says. Luke 1:16-75. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has looked favor of his people and redeemed them. He has raised up a mighty favor for us in the house of his servant David. He's talking about Saul, God,
raised Jesus as a fulfillment of the Davidic covenant. Then a few verses later, verse 22, thus he has shown the mercy promised to our ancestors and has remembered his covenant, the oath that he swore to our ancestor Abraham. So the Davidic covenant fulfills the Abrahamic covenant. That's what the New Testament says. The same thing. It's a renewal of the Abrahamic covenant. So David restored the royal priestly primogeniture that Israel forfeited at Sinai and Beth Peor. In the Old Testament, the New Covenant is possible because of God's oath to David, just as God's oath to Abraham makes possible the continuation of God's covenant relationship with Israel after their sin in Sinai. The oath to Abraham and the oath to David are the two unchangeable things, which are the sure and steadfast anchor of the soul for us. So, but there is also a relationship between the Davidic covenant and the Adamic covenant. Because in Hebrews 2, Jesus is the Son of Man in whom what was said in Psalm 8 is fulfilled. Jesus is the Son of Man under whom God submits everything, all the animals. David King is the Son of Man. This is an Adamic imagery. Jesus provides, note this also, Jesus provides the rest lost by the seed of Adam, the rest of Sabbath in chapter 4 of Hebrews at the tree, and lost by the seed of Abraham at Sinai and also when they did not want to enter into the land of Canaan. So he is, by taking death for us, he recovers that rest, and by enduring the cross through faith, he makes possible to enter into the rest of God. So I'm going to jump this, and I'm going to say the following. The atonement is based in a relationship. There is this relationship between the firstborn and the house, the priest and the people, the king and the kingdom. As incarnation, Jesus joined our house, people, kingdom, and shared our destiny. As firstborn priest, king, he bears our iniquity when he forgives us. His reputation is damaged because of our sins. And I would like to, I don't have time to go with for what James says in Colton Character chapter 16, which is very interesting. But his reputation is damaged, just like the reputation of the CEO of a company that fails. But then, Jesus became the firstborn priest, king of a sinful house, people of God, a kingdom, and carried our sins. We enter his house, people, kingdom, to share the benefits of his faithfulness. Now I'm going to finish with this. What you see here is the photo of my dog. His name is Troy. And Troy is a very interesting dog. We paid for him $5. So the toy is not particularly a fine dog. But he is very curious. To make a long story short, once he adopted a cat. I don't know why, but he adopted a cat. He loved that cat. That was a slim, sickly cat that was stray, and one day we noticed that the cat was beginning to eat Troy's food. And Troy was okay with that. And then we began to notice that the cat slept in Troy's house. And then we noticed that the same things that we did to Troy in his chest were the same things that he did with his mouth into the chest of the cat. We thought that he was going to kill him. No, he was playing and the cat was okay with it. They had a very good relationship. And Troy adopted this cat and loved him and shared with him his food, his house, everything he had. So we decided to adopt the cat. So we took the cat to the veterinary and put him a collar and everything. So he became our cat. The question is, why did the cat
received all the benefits that we gave to Troy, because the cat was Troy's cat. He was loyal to Troy. Just as the Davidic king, if he is faithful, his benefits fall and go through him as mediator to all the people. This dog, he continued to be faithful to us. The benefits we showered on him were also enjoyed by whom? By the cat. I want to suggest that expiation happens when we fully identify with him, with Jesus, so that he becomes our firstborn priest king in such a way that our destinies are what? Are united. If Jesus is faithful, we reap what? His benefits. If Jesus is not faithful, then we have a problem. You see, and this is what happens in Hebrews 9:15-22. The one who dies is the Davidic king, is the firstborn, is the priest who represents the people of God. And God gives to us the benefit through him, who is perfect, seamless. Thank you very much.